Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile, and smart speaker. This is Upfront on Love Sport.
You're listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 till 3pm on Love Sport Radio.
This is Love Sport.
Now, tonight, of course, Premier League action, because we've got Liverpool taking on Southampton. I can't quite get my head round Friday night Premier League football. I don't mind it, conceptually, although I appreciate if you're a Liverpool fan having to go to Southampton on a Friday night for 8 o'clock. You're probably having to have taken about 2 days off work just to make sure you get there and back in time. So, not ideal, I have to admit, but... Yeah, all right. I'm sure it's exciting. It gives it an added je ne sais quoi. So, sure, all power to it. Now, I really do worry, though, about games like this. Because Liverpool will be big favourites. Of course they will. Because they are contending for the Premier League title. And Southampton, let's be perfectly frank, are not. They haven't been for a long time. And they won't be for a long time. Sure, they've played reasonably well. In the last few weeks, they've shown that they're okay. They've got themselves out of the relegation zone. I think they're, 5 points clear now? So they've managed to avoid some of the worst of the relegation zone, but no one really expects them to win tonight. And that's a problem, because this is the whole point of the Premier League, isn't it? And we saw it earlier this week when we had 3 games on one night, Tottenham hosting Palace. Of course, that game was famous for other reasons. We had City hosting Cardiff, Chelsea hosting Brighton. All at home, all big top six sides who will hope to be playing in the Champions League next year. Against sides who are not, and who can't really even dream of Champions League football. Brighton lost to Chelsea at Stamford Bridge, of course, and they've now lost 7 of their 9 matches against top six opposition this year. The manager, Chris Hughton, who is, look, one of the longest serving and one of the most effective managers in the Premier League, he said, basically, the quality can wear you down. Neil Warnock, the Cardiff manager, said his side were 40-1 in a two-horse race. So then when, like, Jurgen Klopp comes out and does his pre-match press conference and finds himself having to say, oh, you know, well, we'll have a listen. He said Liverpool need to be at their best against an in-form opponent.
Analyse was very interesting because it doesn't look like a team who fights for the league, we would say. Yeah? They look confident. They do... what they do, and they stick to it, and that's good. If the games they lost were rather unlucky, then that they played bad, I would say.
Pull the other one, Jürgen. He's got bells on. Honestly, I know this is what managers have to do. They have to stand there and say, well, yes, you know, I think it's going to be a difficult game, and you know, we have to work hard, and every team has always got a chance of winning on the day. I'm sorry, but they don't. Like, Southampton legitimately have almost no chance of winning tonight because Liverpool are who they are. Southampton, by the way, are 8-1 with the bookies to win a home game. 8-1. That means if you played this game 10 times, Southampton might win it twice. But probably just once. A home game against a team 10 or 12 places, 15 places above them in the Premier League. In terms of an FA Cup upset, that shouldn't be that big. But the gulf that is developing between these top sides and these not top sides... Because I wouldn't want to... I don't think Southampton should be battling for relegation. I don't think they're that poor, but they are, as it happens. But they definitely shouldn't be as far away from Liverpool as they will be tonight. And the same with Brighton at Chelsea and Cardiff at Man City. No one in the bottom half has a chance of winning at the Etihad. That's what Neil Warnock said. The bottom half. Now, the statistics, and Ollie Kay points this out very well in his piece in the Times today, reflect that. Show that between Cardiff, Fulham and Huddersfield Town, the current bottom three, they've played 31 league games against the Big Six this season and they've lost every single one. Not even a draw. Not even a scrappy 0-0 or a late goal to grab an equaliser and steal a point. Not even at home. In no circumstances have the relegation sides this year got anything out of the top six teams. Rafa Benitez... got Newcastle to beat City in January. That was remarkable. But they've lost all their other 10 games against them. Watford are 8th. And since beating Tottenham back in September, they've lost 9 out of 9 against top 6 opposition. That is completely staggering. And you know what? It's worrying. It's worrying for the world's most watched and most lucrative league. The selling point of the Premier League, which remember generates billions of pounds of revenue every year, is its unpredictability, the fact that anyone can beat anyone on a given day. You know, the cut and thrust, the excitement, the fact that when Bournemouth go and travel to City, they do have a chance, or at least that's what it used to be. But now, these Super Sundays, when Man United play Brighton and Huddersfield Town have Liverpool coming to town, it's more of a chance for these, you know, plucky underdogs to spend 90 minutes admiring the superstars that their club could never dream of buying, who deign to turn up on the other side of the pitch and knock it round for 90 minutes and win 3-0. I'm not saying that these upsets don't still happen, but they're definitely rarer. I've often talked about the bottom 14 in the Premier League, and it is that. There are people talk about mini-leagues. I think there are two. There's the top six, and there's the bottom 14. And think about promotion and relegation from those two. Wolves are top of the bottom 14 at the moment, after an excellent win, to be fair, against Manchester United. Still quite a rarity, of course. But they were good. They play very well, and it put them firmly into seventh place. So they're just creeping up on United in sixth. They're just the 14 points off moving up another place. 14 points, 17 goals in goal difference. That's an enormous gap. I don't even need to tell you how big the gulf is then, because it's right there in black and white. A 14-point gap between 6th and 7th. This is a Wolves who spent a lot of money. They've just paid 32 million quid for Raul Jimenez to make that permanent. They got João Moutinho, Ruben Neves, Diogo Jota. All talented players who they're paying decent wages, and who, when they're able to sit back and counter-attack, can actually take on those top six on an individual day. But because they have no ability to seemingly control the game, they don't have the experience of being the favourites in games, perhaps, or they struggle anyway when teams sit back for whatever reason, they're never going to be a top-tier side. And actually, even if they were finding ways to win those games, I don't know if they'd be a top-six side. Because the gulf in quality and in spending, I think Wolves could spend £300 million this summer and still finish seventh. Because that's how big the gap is. Why does it exist? Well, it's a number of reasons. Champions League prize money. The fact that Premier League prize money is so weighted, and it's going to get worse, by the way. The top six clubs are desperate to get their hands on a deal like the one they have in Spain, where Barcelona and Real Madrid basically take home triple what anyone else gets. Actually, the Premier League prize money is relatively egalitarian compared to that. But look, maybe we're lucky. Maybe I'm bemoaning a problem that other countries have far worse. The French League, where Paris Saint-Germain are occasionally challenged by one team. Or Germany, where Bayern Munich run away with it. Juve, who are, what, 15 points clear at the top of Serie A. Maybe we have it quite good to only have a top six. But pity the 14 teams who spend their life hoping that they might one day get that dreamy finish of seventh.
Love Sport.
On the line to help us preview the Grand National, a bit of entry, is Neil Watson, horse racing journalist. Let's have a little look ahead to tomorrow, just because I wanted to ask you about Gordon Elliott's quotes that I was reading today, saying, "I wasn't born with a silver spoon in my mouth. I don't come from a horse background. Everything I have, I've worked very hard for it." This man is going to saddle 13 horses in the Grand National tomorrow. What makes him more special than any other trainer?
Well, obviously, having the horses is one thing. It's how you place them. I mean, you look at football managers, they have to manage something like 30 egos every week. So for a trainer who's got 90, that's even harder. I just think he's an actual horseman, because he's trained a Grand National winner before. He was a fair amateur jockey himself. So it's just management. That's all you can explain. Management and a good feel for a horse.
I don't know if you've met him at all, but he seems like a very quietly spoken guy. Like he's not, like he's not really a trainer who comes out and says a huge amount. Is there anything that jockeys say or that grooms say that sets him apart?
Well, look, training horses, it's all a team effort. It may have the one name on the licence, but it's all the stable hands who muck the horses out, gallop them, school them, the trainers who ride them. You know, they know them inside out like no one else. Mm. Something we couldn't know about. And it's just like any other sport. You have to get your players conditioned, get them trained, get them fed well, make sure that they behave themselves. It's just the same with horses.
All right, I'll tell that to Roy Hodgson when he goes into horse training. I'm sure that'll be very interesting. Neil, thanks so much for joining us. I look forward to the race tomorrow, and good luck as well. That's Neil Watson, horse racing journalist, been joining us all week to talk about the action from Aintree. Of course, the Grand National, 5:15 tomorrow. Don't miss it. You can tune into Love Sport Radio, where our live show will be giving you all the updates from Aintree, and also keep you up to date with whether your sweepstake horse has fallen at the first.
This is Love Sport.
Prosh Sports reporter Guy Watts is in the room, and the first thing I have to do is nobble him for his sweepstake horse, Grand National Sweepstake, one of the great traditions of the office. What have you got, Guy? It's a tough unfold, I know.
Don Polly.
Don Polly. Okay, now this is this horse is described as a cult legend. Like, it's been around the block.
Is he?
He's one of Gordon Elliott's.
He is.
You'll have to. So I also believe that you'll have to check the colours, because he's got Gordon Elliott colours at the moment, but they will change. I think he's one of the horses that's been sold, so has changed allegiances.
Right. I see.
So I don't know, big money signing. Maybe. I mean, I say big money. It's only 170,000.
I'm not heartened, James, by the little description on my sweepstake bit. Another from the yard who is a shadow of former years. This dual Cheltenham Festival winner, that's good, mind you, has not looked in love with the game for a while now. 66-1.
Sounds weirdly familiar. But, you know, but they all count, Guy, and it's the Grand National. This is the joy of
P.
it.
P. Mullins. Is that a Paddy Mullins?
Yes, I believe. Yes, it is. So this is actually Willie Mullins' son.
Is it?
He's an amateur rider.
Okay.
Interesting. But it's a weird choice of jockey, given, you know, Willie Mullins is Gordon Elliott's, like, greatest rival.
I suppose, but... Maybe Gordon Elliott doesn't rate him as a jockey.
I tell you what, mate, it would be a heck of a story if Don Polly does pull off a remarkable win. But you are, of course, also here to talk about the first day of the County Championship. Always a bit of a special day for, cricketing nerds, basically, because the County Championship is an acquired taste that not everyone has the hunger for, but it's been a busy morning so far.
It has, yeah. It's always a strange day when it comes around, because it always comes around so much earlier than you're expecting. It's literally just after the clocks go forward. You're still fully in kind of football season mode, just after the Six Nations. Suddenly cricket's back. And, of course, it needs to start now. It's always started in April. It needs to start in early April now because of the number of competitions they play. There's a couple of rounds of the County Championship in April, and the first ones have started this morning. There are six games, three in each division. The most interesting, most noteworthy event to happen this morning was probably Lewis Rees being bowled off the very first ball of the season by Chris Rushworth up at Durham.
What particular metal of duck is that? I mean, gold doesn't cover it, because golden's just the first baller, right? Diamond, I believe, is first of the inning, so it is already both those.
It is something more,
isn't
it?
It's like a platinum or... like... riboid or something.
It's something ridiculous.
Some as yet undiscovered.
It's the sort of thing that you speculate as a kid. You hear about a golden duck and then diamond duck. You say, I wonder what his first ball is. And then you assume it just never happens. But no, Lewis Rees managed to have that happen to him. And then two balls later, Chris Rushworth took another. Wayne Madsen left Derbyshire 0-2. They've sort of recovered to 68-5, if you can call that a recovery. That's at Derby rather than at Durham. But yeah, it doesn't look like easy conditions for batting in the Midlands this morning.
I should point out that Derbyshire won that toss and batted. So that looks like an error. I was reading about Lewis Rees earlier because I heard that he had been dismissed to the first ball of the season. It's worse because he missed the last 3 months of last season with a foot injury. So he hasn't faced a competitive delivery in first-class cricket in about 9 months.
And it showed. there's a couple of other things that cricket fans will be interested to hear. A couple of potential England batsmen, people who we're going to be talking about a lot, I suspect, over the next couple of months leading up to the Ashes. James Vince, the Hampshire captain, he opened the batting, as we expected him to do, down at the Aegeus Bowl. Hampshire chose to bat first, and they are 71-2 at lunch. And the big disappointment for James Vince will be that he was out just before, on the stroke of lunch, he was caught leg before wicket by Ravi Bapara.
Oh, well, at least he didn't nick off playing a big drive.
I was going to do it. The good news for James Vince is that he wasn't out caught in the slips. Yeah. The bad news is he was out LBWs to Ravi Bapara,
No, Ravi Bapara sort of doddled them up at about 72 miles an hour.
When he was in his prime, he didn't bowl very quickly. So at 35, I don't know. I think he's
now
getting there. 33,
that
4, 5, something
old,
like that.
Crikey.
Yeah, exactly.
What of Ben Duffy?
Made a good 40, though. So
right, well,
not a bad start. It's not going to be easy batting anywhere on April the 5th or whatever we are.
Given that it was hailing in central London yesterday, I wouldn't
exactly
fancy it. What of Ben Duckett? He's my pick to open the batting in the Ashes.
Yeah, he didn't do badly. He scored 43 off 51 balls, a typically Ben Duckett inning. 7 boundaries in that as Nottinghamshire got off to a good start. That's sort of the feature match. Talk about the feature race at Aintree. The feature match of this first round has to be Nottinghamshire versus Yorkshire, two of the test match ground counties, and this one's at Trent Bridge. And Nottinghamshire have reached 112 for one against Yorkshire at lunch, so they've made a good start, really, and not least in part because of Ben Duckett, also Ben Slater, who came in along with Duckett over the summer. Not so one of those counties that have really bolstered themselves over the summer, and it looks like it's paying off because they've started well against a Yorkshire team, including, don't forget, Joe Root.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about Joe Root because he obviously had a busy winter because he's a busy man. He's just the kind of person you can never pin him down, honestly. Trying to have lunch with him is a nightmare. And he's played a lot of cricket over the winter. He played the Tests, the ODIs, and the T20 Internationals in the West Indies. He was out in Sri Lanka as well. He's now playing for Yorkshire in, what, two Red Bull games. He's then going to play the World Cup. He's then going to play the Ashes. Isn't he just overstretching himself a little bit? It's a lot of cricket.
Should we start the Joe Root needs a sabbatical campaign?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as you were saying, because yesterday my captain was saying Alistair Cook could have done with one and might have prolonged his career.
We missed the boat with Cook. Maybe we should get one in for Root early.
Why? Look, you say it's early. The man's played 80 test matches.
No, that's true.
He's 20. I know he's...
James, what are you suggesting? Ahead of the biggest summer of his life and of cricket that anyone can remember, that we just give our captain and most important player a couple of months off? Look, I kind of get the logic, generally speaking, and maybe this time in a year from now we might be saying, look, he did hopefully great things this summer, he's earned a bit of a rest, but it's I think a little bit early to be talking those terms. He is a cricketer ultimately, he paid a lot of money to do it, and he should be playing cricket, I think. And you know, a couple of Red Bull games for Yorkshire I don't think are going to drastically affect his performances when it comes to the real business end of things in the Ashes in the World Cup later in the summer.
If he gets a cold, which is very likely, because he's playing...
he was wearing a beanie hat when he was interviewed on TV yesterday, so
I'm amazed they haven't got some beanie hats they can wear on the field of play. In fact, surely some people have tried that.
I wonder, are they actually nothing... not allowed, or
well, no,
are people just too embarrassed?
I can't think of anything against it, but I do remember the West Indies coming in the days when we just basically used to screw the West Indies over with the scheduling, and they turned up and had played a three-match series that started on about the 15th of February, and they played it, and of course they played at Headingley, and Chris Gayle was wearing so many jumpers that he actually failed to take a catch at slip because he couldn't get his arms into the middle of his body. I think he had legitimately about four jumpers on. I've never seen a man look so unhappy on a cricket pitch.
Jason Holder, by the way, playing for Northamptonshire for a little bit this season, so he, I imagine, is suitably dressed up on what is inevitably a fairly chilly day in up the M1 corridor. By the way, they're playing Middlesex, so London listening fans of Middlesex might be interested to know that Stephen Finn and Toby Rowland-Jones opened the bowling for them today, and what must surely be the best new ball bowling pair, certainly in action on this round of fixtures. Steve Finn, by the way, turned 30 last week.
Did he?
Where has the time gone?
And like, when is he going to be able to grow a full beard? Honestly, I feel like he
he's
might
one
not...
of those. If he can't by now, he never will. Some people just can't.
No, it's true.
Fine.
Yeah, it's all right, Ben. Don't worry. One day you'll get there. One day. Yeah, well, maybe when you hit puberty or something. Now, I hear Nick Holt's been writing about women's cricket and how it could be a big year for sort of transformation in that particular
field.
Yeah,
definitely. So it's been part of a really interesting series from Nick Holt in the Telegraph, a sort of special report, if you like, into different areas of the game. He's talked about in other editions of this, talked about how cricket is showing some worrying tendencies of maybe starting to copy football's culture of sacking coaches and whatever you, or what, director of cricket or whatever you want to call these people, a little bit more quickly than they've been used to doing, a sign of maybe the way the game's developing, catching up, you might say, with certain other sports. But today it's about the £20 million shake-up of women's cricket that's actually coming into place next summer. So this summer is the last of women's cricket being played in the current formats and the way it is. Basically, at the moment, we've got 34 women's county teams, but that's going to be reduced to between 8 and 10 next year. It's a similar idea. It's to streamline. It's to essentially make it easier to follow. It's to increase the number of professionals, just 22 professional female cricketers in the country at the moment. They want to get that up to 90 cricketers earning a living from cricket in the next couple of years. Within the next 4 years is the project. And yeah, it's going to cost £20 million to essentially transform this sort of loads of county teams to a much more streamlined version, but the hope is that in the long run it'll be for the benefit of the game, it'll benefit the England team. There'll be much stiffer competition for places because the women's county game It has professional competitions for the limited over stuff, the white ball stuff, but it's amateur at Red Bull level. So people talk about how it just doesn't do anything for their game playing county cricket. You have to be playing in whether it's the Kia Women's Super League or the other white ball competitions to be getting any sort of chance of getting England recognition. And the money they're on, even as professionals at the moment, between 20 and 50 grand a year, is obviously pretty small. I know it's not actually that long since the men weren't earning that much more than that, but it still seems that given the rise in professionalism we've seen in women's sport generally over the last few years, an interview with Phil Neville in the Mail today talking about how we've got a fantastic chance to really kind of capitalise on the growing popularity of women's football, and cricket's having to compete with more sports than ever. Netball, of course, has a World Cup later this year. There's also the Football World Cup for the women as well. So it's got stiff competition, cricket, and it doesn't want to be left behind. It's a significant development next year.
Yeah, and it wouldn't, if it did get left behind, it wouldn't be the first time. So I hope that cricket has learnt from its mistakes of the past. Guy Watts, Posh Sports supporter, thank you very much for coming in. And of course, don't forget Don Polly with the horse you're following in the Grand National tomorrow.
This is Love Sport.
That emotional night at the new Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, which needs a name, really. That's the current thing I'm really struggling with. Is I know they were trying to sell the naming rights to a sponsor and they couldn't. So now we still have to call it the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, which is a very strange name. Maybe they should just call it New White Hart Lane. I don't know why that would be such a problem. I would quite like that, actually. In fact, you know what? That's what I'm going to call it. I'm just going to call it New White Hart Lane. If they don't like it, if Uber don't like it when they pay to sponsor it, well, they can come and tell me themselves. Actually, Ben, we shouldn't annoy Uber because they get us home. Realistically, when I'm in my worst state, it's Uber that gets me home. Other taxi firms are available, of course, self-driven or otherwise. But they are the people who sort me out. So what are you going to do? Yeah, Tottenham, of course, getting that win. I didn't think they were perfect. Thought they were a little bit edgy. But it was important to get that off their back, to get their first league win in six, by the way. So no shame in just getting the 3 points, no matter what the occasion. And now they have to prepare for what is an absolutely enormous game, to which I've just been offered a ticket, which is great news. Tottenham are taking on Manchester City in the Champions League quarterfinal. I didn't get offered it for free. I'm paying for it. Someone couldn't go. I'm not utilising my connections to try and, you know, get tickets to games I shouldn't be going to. I'm not even a Tottenham fan, admittedly, but it will be a special night, I'm sure. Can they spring a surprise? I don't know. I don't know if they can. I think being at home first doesn't benefit them, because if you're away in the first leg, you can sort of try and keep it tight and then come back home and the game opens up a little bit more. Whereas, realistically, you don't want to give the tie away in the first, in the first sort of, what, 90, 150 minutes of the tie? You don't want to just throw it away. So I would be a little bit concerned for Tottenham because of the way the draw has come out. Look, they wouldn't want to draw Man City at all, because getting to the Champions League quarterfinal is such an important moment for Tottenham as a club. And this is where they have to start challenging now. I've said before that Tottenham's squad is not strong enough to compete at the very, very highest level, on, you know, in the way that City are, for example, across four different tournaments, in to try and create history in that particular way. And they need some investment. But they also need to be punching, even now, if they think they're going to get a better opportunity. Man City, I know they're brilliant, but I don't think they're as good as, say, a Barcelona. I don't think they're as good as, perhaps, a Juventus. And this is an opportunity. And they get to do it, most of all, in that fabulous new stadium. One man who was there for the opening of their new stadium was former Tottenham midfielder Paul Miller, who's on the line now. Paul, did it live up to expectations?
Yeah, more so. Absolutely fantastic. I think you, I don't know if you know any many Spurs fans, but you won't meet anyone who was there on Wednesday that wouldn't have said it was fantastic and wonderful and everything that we hoped and prayed it would be. Magnificent structure.
I wonder if it was a little bit, for someone like you, tinged with sadness, because obviously the old White Hart Lane isn't there anymore. Were you sad to say goodbye to the old place?
No, because we have to move into it in the future. I'd say what was sad, and I was sitting obviously in a corporate area, but there's a lot of people with tears at the start when in the open ceremony, which was done very tasty and very, you know, fantastic with the Glory, Glory, Hallelujah, the gospel choir, everything else, and the opera singers. People crying. I was also a bit sad myself, because you do remember the old days. You know, I lost my father, so you'd remember my dad would like to have been there. My mum was there anyway the other night. So I think it was a case of people arcing back from the past of how it used to be and how it is now. So I think it was quite, there was a bit of sadness to begin with. you know, people getting quite emotional of growing up in the old stadium, and you know, and obviously, and I was one of them as well. So it was terrific, really. But we're all so pleased that we're there. I mean, this is the best football stadium in the world, and it's not, they haven't skimped at all on it. Everything's there. It's proper class.
Did it still feel like Tottenham? Because what I loved about White Hart Lane, look, I'm not a Spurs fan, but one of my best friends is, and we used to go. And what I loved about it was it felt very unique. It felt like Tottenham. Does the new place have that feel yet?
Well, I asked a lot of people the other night, and everyone's saying it does still feel like it because it's still very close to the pitch. I mean, you know, the new 17,500 stand, south stand, is massive, enormous, and noise generating from that. So yes, it does. It's a very tall stadium. You know, you're looking down. It's not a bad sitting house. And yes, the atmosphere is wonderful, and it don't not feel like the Lane. But obviously, it's a different structure. You know, it's just enough twice the size of the old stadium. I mean, it's a magnificent thing what we've done there. And you know, I mean, I'm not knocking the Emirates and Wembley, but you know, they're 11, 12 years old now.
Yeah,
they look a little bit old fashioned compared to what we have now, you know?
And yeah.
It's not their fault, by the way, because at the time they were state-of-the-art, but they're not anymore. And, you know, just look at technology.
Yes,
forward.
Yeah, it has.
You know, and Spurs have encumbered all that and made it all great like that, you know? So it was fantastic. I mean, and I just think it can only take us to higher and better places now.
The key now for me really is that Tottenham need to follow the spending and the ambition of the stadium with some spending and ambition of the squad. How much work do you think they need to do on this group of players?
I think we'll be buying 3 or 4 players in the summer. I think there'll be a few leave, obviously, always is. But there'll be people that were maybe a bit surplus. I have no doubt there'll be money made available. I mean, it hasn't been the last couple of years, and that's for obvious reasons. When you're building a billion-pound complex. But I think there will be new players in. I think the only thing with us, knowing Mauricio well, we want to buy the right type of players. We ain't buying a 28, 29-year-old midfield centre-forward. We're buying a young player, preferably English, if we can, who can make a better player. So I'm not saying we ain't going to buy top players, but they're not going to be, you know, established Spanish international 29-year-old.
Like Fernando Llorente. You're not going to do that again then?
That was a different one, wasn't it? Cover, really.
Yeah.
I mean, he was in Olga. You know what I'm saying? He was quite cheap.
Yeah.
So I'm just saying this. I think you know, if you say you're spending 100 million, you'd say, well, we get 3 decent players in, yeah?
Which,
you know, maybe 2 of those will be English.
Yeah. Which area do you think they need to look at most importantly?
We need a fullback, and I think we need a midfield player and maybe another striker. You know, it's just one of each, really. That's what we need. Depends who leaves as well. I mean, there's talk of Eriksen and Toby leaving. I don't think they will. I think where they're going to go and bet themselves, unless they went to Man United, Barcelona and Real Madrid, they ain't going to go anywhere better, yeah?
Well, yeah, there's talk of Christian Eriksen going to Real Madrid, and I worry because he's not signed a contract, and they've been talking about
it for
months.
That's all crap, by the way. I think it's Daniel has to wait a little while, make sure we qualify for the Champions League, because you know nowadays with budget, that's a tremendous asset to have, you know, more money in the bank, the Champions League. Christian's very close with Harry. So are both their partners. They live near each other, around the corner from each other. I don't see Christian leaving at all.
Yeah. Just finally, we've obviously got this massive Champions League quarterfinal coming up against Man City. Do you think Tottenham have got a chance?
You've got a real chance. I think real bonus having a weekend off this week. This time of year, it gets a weekend off in April, normally, yeah? whatever you think about tomorrow's Brighton and City, I mean, obviously, our mate Chris Hughton's there, a great friend. He's going to make it difficult for City. There's no foregone conclusion on the semi-final, by the way. You know, there's no easy games in the semi-final. They will have a difficult game, Man City, undoubtedly, and probably Pepper's reiterated that. And we ain't going to play them until, you know, we play them on Tuesday. So, I'm saying we've got a real chance. If we play at our best, we can beat them. They're a good side. Well, I think all the top six sides can beat each other when they play well. And we play well with this new stadium and the atmosphere. We've got a great chance.
Just finally, Paul, you will have seen these comments from Danny Rose that have been in the back of the papers today, which actually quite saddened me in some ways. I just wondered what your initial reaction to it was, to hear a guy, you know, in the peak of his career, say, I'm just waiting for this all to be over.
Yeah, it's quite sad, isn't it? I mean, we all know what, you know, we yay from FIFA, the lack of response to the racism and stuff and whatever. Until they sort it out, it's going to carry on having the same argument. I don't believe walking off the pitch is right. I think you've got to make some sort of demonstration, but I don't know how that is at the moment. I think closing stadiums is going to be the right way. You hurt fans where it's, they can't see the games. But unfortunately, it's a world problem. It's not a football problem, yeah? So I don't know how you deal with it, but they have got to be more stringent and more stricter on the various associations. But walking off the pitch, I'm not sure that works, to be honest. I think it just, otherwise you sort of like all of a sudden the crowd, and to say the crowd don't do it on purpose when their team's losing 2-0, yeah? With 10 minutes to go.
So it's
a difficult one to manage there. That's a difficult one to manage. What I'm saying is they can just get support from all the people around them, the management, everything else, the clubs, the national associations. Gareth Southgate's been fantastic the way he's handled it the last couple of weeks, and the FA for a change. But you just got to go with it. It's a political problem. It's not a football problem. It's the world problem, yeah?
Paul, thank you so much.
We live in that world now.
Time's just catching up with us, but thank you very much for joining us. That's Paul Miller, former Tottenham player, telling us all about what's going on at Spurs at the moment. Yeah, it was sad to read those Danny Rose comments this morning, because football's one of those things where everyone dreams of it. Everyone absolutely dreams of becoming... it's our national sport. England say they invented it. Good news, by the way, this week, that the Football Association are going to rename themselves as the England Football Association. Well, probably, assuming they get it through, the English Football Association, to try and get rid of some of the arrogance of calling themselves the Football Association, as if there are no other ones in the world. But you know what? If they do, and I didn't necessarily mind them calling themselves Football Association, but I understand the idea of renaming themselves the English Football Association. But it shouldn't make them scared of taking responsibility for big problems. And racism's clearly a big problem in football at the moment. I don't think there's any more of it than there used to be. Maybe there's less, but we're much, much better at talking about it and reporting it, and that's important. But what is now also important is the reaction to it. How do the FA or the EFA or the EFL or the Premier League or whoever... Don't sit there and say, it's not my problem, it's for UEFA to deal with it. And UEFA, oh, it's not our problem, it's for FIFA to deal with it. Take responsibility for it. It's happening in your backyard to the people who make your product great, i.e. players. Danny Rose, maybe not single-handedly, but has helped improve this country's footballing magic. And that he wants to just walk away is tragic indeed. This problem's not going to go away unless someone makes it go away.
This is Love Sport.
Liverpool are in action tonight. 8 o'clock kickoff at St Mary's up against Southampton. They could go back to the top of the Premier League. And the Grand National will be run on Saturday at 5:15 p.m. We've been talking about it all week. It is, of course, the 4 miles, 514 yards over 30 fences. It is perhaps the most iconic race in British horse racing, maybe in world horse racing, up there with a few of the Kentucky Derby, maybe the Arc de Triomphe, but it's right up there. Tiger Roll, of course, won it last year under Davy Russell for Gordon Elliott. He will start as favourite once again. Lots of different opinions about what he might offer that particular horse. He's going to go off at about 7-2, I believe, which is pretty short. It was interesting to hear John McCrick, racing legend, talking to Love Sport Radio earlier this week, and he was asked about exactly whether Tiger Roll was worth it.
So much can go wrong at Aintree, and I'm saying to anybody who thinks of backing Tiger Roll, don't be stupid, because if you can't find a better carpet winner during the whole of the season than in the 40-runner Grand National, well, you must be ready for the funny farm. It's ridiculous. Raf Vinden from Ireland is a very good winner in Ireland. It jumps well. It's got a bit of class, so I'd say Raf Vinden.
And there's plenty of talk about Raf Vinden. John McCrick is not the only one interested in that six-time winner. I think it is an interesting horse because it's a Willie Mullins trained one. He, of course, one of the most successful trainers in jump racing. 11 years old, you need that sort of experience in a horse to try and stay the distance. One last time out at Fairy House, beating Alpha Des Oboe, who's quite the serious horse as well. So there you go. If you pull Raf Vinden in the office sweepstake, then that will please you. We had Oliver Brett, horse racing journalist, on Up Front with James Gray earlier this week. Let's hear what he thinks about the National.
The horse I've had a little bit of money on is Lakeview Lad, who came third in a very tough handicap at Cheltenham. So staying on in the manner that suggests an extra mile would really suit. Maybe it's that they've said there's a slight issue with the ground, but I've looked back at his form and I think he's done okay on good to soft ground.
There you go. Lakeview lad is Oliver Brett's pick. Again, sort of not getting much interest from outside of the racing community for whatever reason. I haven't seen many tipsters plump for Lakeview lad, but there you go, Oliver Brett after the Irish horse. And we also had earlier this week the man of the moment, trainer Gordon Elliott, who was due to have 13 in the race. Two of those horses have been sold and will run for New Connections tomorrow. So he's saddling 11 horses. Here's what he said about who he thinks might have a chance from his stable.
Well, obviously, Dunnicus, I think, has got a great chance. The Tyfield is a very, very big price. He's got a good chance. General Principle won last year at Irish National. To be honest, if I name one and don't name another, I'm only leaving the most. Jury Duty, Timmy Hyde's. Jury Duty, I think at the price he's got a good chance.
Gordon Elliott there, the man who will saddle 11 horses tomorrow afternoon. He's going to be extremely busy running up to the 5:15 race. He was going to have 13, by the way, but three of them had been sold just in the last couple of days, including Don Polly, who our Posh Sports reporter Guy Watts pulled out of the sweepstake at 66-1. And it is time for me to do my own Grand National sweepstake. Now, producer Ben's going to observe. So I'm not going to rig it. I can't see any of the horses. We joint folded. You can hear me rattling around the horses in what used to be a pen pot, I believe. Ben, can you confirm that everything is above board?
I can confirm. I've had to come into the studio because you might rig somehow the glass.
Right, okay, yeah.
You know how like in FIFA they used to heat up the balls in order to rig
the time?
Well,
yeah, if you heat this up, then they're actually going to go on fire. Right, so I'm not even looking. Let's see who I've got. This is a big moment. I have awful luck in Grand National sweepstakes. Let's have a look. Oh, hello. Nico de Boinville, Step Back, showed his ability when a wide margin winner of the Bet365 Gold Cup last year. This has been the plan all along. He's shown little spark this term, though. All right, I'll take that. 20-1.
20-1.
Nico de Boinville.
I always think aiming around the 20-1, 14-1s, they've always got a chance. I mean, 1 year, 100-1.
Yeah, Mon Mome. I don't know anyone who had a piece of that, but I think breakfast producer Jamie may have had a little piece of Mon Mome that year. Nico de Boinville is a jockey I like. He's never won the National, but he's very successful. And I have won money on Nico de Boinville before, so hopefully I'll win this sweepstakes.
I'm pretty sure out of the sweepstakes so far, with all our presenters and producers that have pulled it out, that's probably the best one so far.
Yeah, and I'm organising it, which looks bad. I admit that doesn't look
good. That's
always
like when you do a World Cup sweepstake and you end up pulling out Brazil or someone and you think, oh, God.
Well, while you're here, Ben, we should probably get you to pick yours as well, because you've not picked yours yet.
I haven't picked mine yet.
The favourite is still in there, which is my main concern. I'm a bit worried.
Tiger Roll.
I'm a bit worried you might get the favourite.
I had a rubbish one last
year. It's no fun having the favourite. You said you've picked the National winner 3 out of 4 years.
Yeah, so I've had quite good luck, actually. So the past, three winners out of 4 years. I can't remember. I've had many clouds. For Arthur, and then Tiger Roll.
Right.
Tiger Roll last year.
I can't remember for Arthur. That was a rogue winner, wasn't it? That was 14-1 or something.
I say aim for the 14-1, 20-1s around there, and just go for the colours you like, to be honest.
Right. What have you pulled out of the sweepstake, Ben? I'm dying to know. The nation is dying to know.
Warrior's Tale. 40-1.
Oh, okay. That's a pretty big price. What's the advice?
While the 10-year-old has run over the fences before, winning the Grand Sefton, he looked at a ballant non-stayer 12 months ago. A big surprise if he wins.
Well,
there we go.
It's funny because my horse last year was called A Big Surprise. No, I wasn't. I'm joking. I'm joking. Good colours, though. The sort of green and yellow.
Well, I'm colourblind, so it doesn't really help me.
Wait, the Grand National's a nightmare for you.
Oh, yeah. Because I look for the numbers and they're really hard to tell. So basically, I just look and I'm like, right, where's my horse? They're all the same.
We need to do something about this. We should start a campaign. Horse racing for the colourblind. Because horses are colourblind as well, by the way. So they haven't got a clue where their tip is. This is unfair, Ben. We're going to find a way for you to enjoy the Grand National. Maybe you should listen to it on the radio.
Love Sport.
The FA Cup semi-finals. Man City taking on Brighton. But of course, Watford versus Wolves. A really massive day for both of those clubs. It's time to talk to a man who knows all about Watford Football Club. Gavin Mann made more appearances for Watford than I could count. Watford have never won the FA Cup, which people probably don't appreciate. It's quite rare, actually, among top flight sides. What was the furthest that you ever got in the FA Cup with Watford, and did you feel a bit of pressure sometimes on it?
Yeah, I was fortunate to play in, I think it was 2 FA Cup semi-finals. And also a League Cup semi-final. So over the years we've managed to get there as a team. But I think this is a great opportunity for Watford. I think Wolves are a good side as well, so hopefully it'll be an entertaining game.
At what point does it change? Because we often talk these days about how the magic of the FA Cup's a bit gone and it's not quite the same anymore. But at a certain point through the tournament, that seems to change. Is it, you know, once you get into a quarter-final and, you know, you're one game away from Wembley, is that when you really start to get a sniff of it?
Yeah, very much so. I think sometimes it can work both ways because you can have sort of poor form in the league, so you want a sort of a cup run to sort of keep that, get that good momentum back. And Watford, thankfully, are flying the league and they're flying the cup. So it'd be a great occasion. I mean, as a footballer, you know, I was growing up watching FA Cup games and you always wanted to play football as a professional and also get to a cup final. So it'd be a great opportunity for them.
Do you think they... I mean, I know you want to play the big sides, but presumably every Watford fan will be a Brighton fan for a day tomorrow, hoping they can knock out Man City.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so. They're one of the best sides I've seen for many years, Man City. I've watched them live. I've been fortunate to watch them live 3 or 4 times this season. So, but Wolves as well. Me being a Midland lad, I've seen Wolves 4 or 5 times. So that'd be a tough test for Watford the weekend. But you just never know with the FA Cup semi-final.
Well, you mentioned you've watched Wolves a bit this year. They've got this really weird record where they can't beat anyone in the bottom six, but they've beaten almost all of the top six sides. Can you make head nor tail of it? Is it a mindset thing or is it a sort of tactical problem?
I think the biggest thing for me is when I've watched the teams that have played against them, that they've managed to get some against them, they've actually attacked them, which gives Wolves the opportunity to turn over possession and hit them on the break. I think teams that are defensive minded and get a lot of melee on the ball, like a lot of the teams at the bottom, they struggle to break them down. And that's where, like I said, when they play against the sort of good attacking sides, that's when they exploit it. So be interesting what tactics Watford go for the weekend.
So yeah, I wonder then if they might think about sitting back and almost trying to play Wolves at their own game and playing them on the counter. We'll have to see. I also just want to quickly, because we've talked a lot about QPR on the station this week. Of course, they sacked Steve McLaren on Monday. They're looking at maybe bringing Lee Bowyer in to replace him. QPR as a club, over the last 10 years, and I know you left back in 2011, they've become a very odd team to manage. It must be hard to see them go through so many different stages and struggle financially for someone like you who spent a good chunk of time there.
Yeah, it is, yeah. I think when I was there, they had the investment. I thought they got it right because they brought in a lot of players who knew that division and knew what it was like, how to get out of that division. Mm. Where since I've left, they brought in, you know, these big earners from the Premiership, picking up big money, a lot of foreign lads coming in. I think they need to strip it back personally and go back to what I think the QPR fans want, players that are going to fight and scrap. And if you've got that with a little bit of quality going forward, then I think you've got half a chance. Lee Bowyer knows English game very well. I heard that Gareth Ainsworth's name was mentioned. I think Gaz would be great for QPR because he's literally that sort of motivational manager that he gets everyone performing sort of 8, 9, 10 out of 10. You know, commitment. I think that's what QPR need.
Yeah, you've worked with Gareth, obviously, and I suppose you would have played with him as well. What makes him such a good motivator? Because he's been at Wickham for so long now.
Mm-hmm. I think because he knows that it's like similar to, I was chatting to Sean Dyche in the week, and Sean Dyche's his sort of philosophy is you've got to work hard, you've got to put in, you know, he wants his players averaging 13k per game, which Gaz is the same. He wants that attitude of, you know, you've got to be fit, you've got to be organised, you've got to be, you know, run for a bit war for each other, not just a manager, but players themselves. If you get a group of players that bought into that, you can have success. And also with a little bit of quality added, then that's the makings of a good footballer on a good side.
Gav, thanks so much for giving us your expert insight into that. And I'm sure you'll be cheering on Watford at the weekend. It could be a massive day for the club. Thanks very much for coming on the show. That's Gavin Mahon, former midfielder for QPR and Watford and Brentford, by the way. Of course, Watford taking on Wolves, trying to get through to their second ever FA Cup final, but they've never won the whole thing. And by the way, there's so few clubs. You know, the FA Cup's been going 130, 140 odd years. there's actually not many clubs who haven't won it, and Watford are one of those. Remember that when they got back there, Luther Blissett, Love Sport's own Luther Blissett, was still playing for Watford the last time they got to the FA Cup final, and he's ancient.
This is Love Sport.
Now, I said earlier that I did want to talk about Danny Rose, and of course we have to, because he is all over the back pages of the newspapers, and, well, I'm not going to say for the wrong reasons, because it's not as though he's been misbehaving or been in trouble. He's been talking, actually, and basically, I think that talking is good. I'm not an old-fashioned man in that sense. I do think that we should talk about our feelings. We're men and we have feelings, and sometimes we need to talk about them. But how is it that in 2019, we're still talking about footballers being racially abused? I mean, honestly, you know, this is a year when you can be whoever you want to be, apparently, in this country, in what we used to think was a tolerant, multicultural country. And yet, we're still talking about footballers getting racially abused. I've asked myself that question a lot recently. Why are we still talking about it? And I still don't know the answer, actually. But sadly, I've had to talk about it because it keeps happening. The latest story, of course, which you will have seen this morning, is that Danny Rose has been saying, and remember, this is Danny Rose, who was one of the three England players targeted with racial abuse in Montenegro. Danny got it right at the end, it would appear. I mean, look, it happened throughout and he mentions it. But right at the end, he put a challenge in and he got booked for it. Probably wasn't a great challenge. It was fairly innocuous, I thought. But deserving of a yellow card, but not deserving of the round of monkey chants that unbelievably came from the stands in response to it. I mean, really? Is this really what it's come to? That it's not even... Look, as Ian Stone wrote in his Love Sport column this morning, clearly the irony of a bunch of white racists comparing a black footballer to someone lower down on the evolutionary scale was lost on them. Quite right, because these people are absolutely subhuman. There's just no real humanity in someone who thinks it's okay to start abusing someone for the colour of their skin. Never mind in the context of a football pitch. Danny, after the game, Raheem Sterling and Callum Hudson-Odoi talked to the media. Danny didn't. He felt he was too upset and too emotional. He didn't feel that he could speak to the media about it. I completely understand. I might have been the same myself, to be honest. In fact, I think I almost certainly would have been. I read a story even that he'd left his England shirt crumpled up in a pile on the floor of the changing room after England left. Now, that was a really poignant moment because I know a lot of ex-England players of all different, some have got one cap, some have got 70 caps. And every single one of them treasures all the different bits of memorabilia, you know, the commemorative cap, the shirt they played in, probably still got the socks in a drawer somewhere, washed, I hope. But they all treasure them. So for Danny to go, you know what, I don't even want this shirt, I don't want anything to do with what happened here tonight, that was really, really sad for me. And now, even sadder to hear what he's been saying today. He said about football, I've had enough. At the minute, how I program myself, I think I've got 5 or 6 more years left in football. I just can't wait to see the back of it. There's so much politics and whatever in football, I can't wait to see the back of it. Seeing how things are done in the game at the minute, it's just, or whatever, isn't it? I want to get out of it. That's how I feel. I want to enjoy football as much as I can and then go. Grim. Really grim, actually. If you think about it, just forget the football element for a moment. Imagine you're doing a job and it's the job you've always dreamt of doing. Maybe, I don't know, maybe you're a firefighter. Maybe you own a bakery. I don't know. But it's the job you've always dreamed of doing. And all of a sudden, someone starts abusing you. And it's the same bloke every week, because actually it is usually the same group of people. And this guy, every couple of weeks, you walk past his desk and he shouts at you. He says, "Oi! Oi, you!" Shouts some slur at you. Think about that for a minute. And then think about the fact that sometimes when you speak out and say, "That's not fair," or "You shouldn't be doing that," half the office goes, "Yeah, you're right." And half the office goes, "Well, no, mate, you should just get on with it. You know, don't react to it." Like Leonardo Bonucci said this week. Imagine that. And then imagine you're making so much money that actually you feel trapped in the job. You're like, "Well, I've got to, you know, make some money for my mum. And, you know, I've got this big mortgage and I've got a couple of kids." Imagine all of that. And yet you can't leave for 6 years. Actually horrible. And that's what these people have done to Danny Rose. They've put him in this place where he's doing his dream job and he feels trapped in it and all he wants is for this job to be over. Really, really horrible. And I hope that that brings it home a little bit to some of these people who scream this stuff at footballers on the terraces. I hope this makes them realise the consequences of their actions and their words. Because it should. They're actually ruining people's lives. Even, by the way, and it's not just people standing on the terraces, by text. The absolutely shocking story you might have read earlier this week was about Charlton star Lyle Taylor. He was sent a series of anonymous, racially abusive messages after he scored the winner against Bradford. Bradford City are investigating that, which would suggest that it might be a Bradford fan upset at the fact that Lyle's done what he does best, score goals. But actually, one of the other things Lyle does best is talk. And he was on the Charlton fan show last night talking about a whole range of subjects, but especially this racial abuse he received and his future treatment of what if there's racial abuse on the pitch.
I saw Harry Kane had said that if he hears it, or if any player is subjected to that again, he will lead the players off the pitch.
Good.
That's a captain.
Good.
I'm a massive advocate of that. If it happened to me, I will be walking off the pitch. If it happens on the pitch, I will be walking off the pitch. I've said that in an interview today, and I pull no punches and I make no bones about it. I will be walking off the pitch. End of discussion. If the FA or whoever it is feel that they need to punish me for that, then so be it, but I will be walking off the pitch.
That last line, if the FA or whoever feel they need to punish me, that was what actually really got to me. And Lyle was brilliant, and he's so clear in his mind of what he thinks of this and what he's going to do. But that last line was brutal. I didn't always agree with the walking off the pitch thing. I thought a lot of footballers, including the likes of Raheem Sterling, would rather stay on and not give them the power. Not give those racists the power to take away their ability to play football. But I'm coming round to it because I think it would send a very, very strong message. You walk off and you say, you know what? This is not of conditions under which football is able to be played. I can't put myself in the shoes of a black player who has to run up and down the touchline and listen to monkey chants or racist chants. I'll never experience that. But I can listen to the hundreds of black players, even thousands, who have experienced it. And to read that Danny Rose is waiting for his career to end so he can just leave football behind, it's made me completely rethink what the way to deal with this is. Same with Lyle Taylor as well. When he said with such a clear mind last night that he would walk off. And I have very little doubt in my mind now that this is the right thing to do. If there is racist abuse, they should walk away. And football should be ashamed when it happens. If it's a TV game, they should keep showing it, the empty pitch. That's what they should do. Just for the rest of the game, keep the cameras on the empty pitch. Because that might resonate. If the words of Danny Rose, maybe they think because he's black his feelings don't matter. I don't know. If those don't resonate, then maybe the fact that the precious game that they paid to watch, which they think gives them a right to talk in this way, maybe if they're forced to sit there and watch nothing, because that's the alternative, this is the consequence. It's like taking a child and putting them in the naughty corner. Face the wall. Go on, face the wall. Because that's what these people are at best. They're children who don't understand any better. But most of all, Lyle Taylor's words saying, if the FA want to ban me or whatever, so be it. That was what worried me the most and actually made me quite sad as well. Because this guy, Lyle Taylor, he's played professional football for 10, 11 years. He's played for lots of different clubs. And he feels that if he takes action against racism and he stands up and tries to kick racism out, he's going to get punished by the governing bodies. He's going to get punished by the very people who are supposed to be dealing with the problem. How is that right? How can the FA sit there and think they're connected to young footballers when actually those young footballers, and much as Lyle's been playing football for 10 or 11 years as a pro, he is under 30, he is still young, those young black footballers do not feel represented by the governing bodies who are supposed to be stopping the racism. If Lyle Taylor walks off any pitch at any point, I will be right there with him. If any of Lyle's teammates walk off the pitch because of racist abuse, I'll be right there with them. My worry, I don't know if the footballing authorities will be.
Love Sport.
You've been listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 till 3 p.m. on Love Sport Radio. And don't forget to leave us a rating and a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.